You've gotten to where you are today, and everything that we've been through has made us who we are today, and the people we've come in contact with and jobs we've had. Why would you want it any other way? Living for your love can get kind of risky.
Welcome, everybody, to Nashville Drummers Podcast, episode 19 or 20 or something like that.
Episode 19, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's the one.
Our next guest is Nashville-based freelance drummer and educator. He was born in Cape Elizabeth, Maine, and he started playing drums at the age of 3. He moved to Boston to attend Boston University and the Berklee College of Music, where he earned his undergraduate degrees in music education in both drum set and classical performance. After college, he taught privately and moved to LA, where eventually he was called to come move to Nashville, where he is an extremely versatile drummer in multiple genres and just an all-around really good dude. So we're super stoked to welcome John Butterworth to the podcast.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
Thanks for having me.
You said Berklee.
Yes.
Is that I haven't heard of that. Is that
it's not the one
California.
The northwest corner
with two E's, no Y.
Correct. Yeah. You know why it's called Berklee. The founder's name was Lee Burke. Super original.
Are you kidding?
I
didn't know
that. No. So they just flipped it.
Wow. Wait, really?
Yeah. So like Berklee, California was like L-E-Y.
Yeah.
It was Lee Burke. So he just said, it'll be called Berklee.
Interesting.
It's like Inspan
so,
Dan.
So he basically, he got the inspiration from gym class.
Okay, this podcast
Burke,
is now.
Lee?
Yeah.
All right.
See?
Podcast drummers?
Drummers?
Nashville?
Nashville?
We're doing the whole interview backwards now.
It's like Yoda?
Podcast?
Yeah.
Nashville drummers? Yeah.
Oh my God.
That's hilarious. But yeah, crazy stuff.
Wow. Well, yeah, you were one of the first guys that I met in town. Remember we had coffee?
I loved that.
Americana, right?
I think the first time was Stay Golden.
Stay Golden. Oh, yeah, you're
and
right.
And then we did Americano, yeah. I think, afterwards.
Oh, I thought you were remembering his order.
That I was would like, be
why
amazing.
Would I remember his order?
Holy moly.
He got a biscuit with jam.
No, I think the first time, and I thought you were going to be like, no, I think the first time I got a mocha, I'm like, Lord, these cats have some serious memory.
Weird.
I'm like, because I've got a pretty dang good memory for seeing things like that, but that would be like, all right, I gotta go home, guys. It's canceled. I've got some serious work to do.
Question your life decisions. Yep.
These guys are, I'm like, because I don't remember birthdays. I don't remember that it's my own birthday. That's a true story. I sometimes will.
Well, the older you get, right? Is that what it is?
Yeah. And it's just, it has never mattered to me.
Yeah.
But I'm right. just, but also gets me in trouble because I forget everyone else's birthday too.
No, that's
too.
A problem.
That's what Google Calendar is for, or like Apple Calendar.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Facebook.
Put on, exactly, Facebook. Yeah.
Or just having a wife who can tell you that it's your friend's birthday.
Or yours.
Yeah.
Honey, it's your birthday today.
Right. What do you want to do on your birthday?
Honey, it's my anniversary.
I don't know.
No, that's a bad one.
That's a bad
one.
That I remember. At least a few days beforehand. I'm like, oh yeah, it's going to be our anniversary. Better get her something.
Mylar balloons.
Oh, what about Kevlar?
A little heavier.
Yeah.
More protective, though.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah.
No, I love.
It's going to be good. It's going to be good.
I think you just reached out on Instagram. Or
yeah,
Facebook.
I don't remember how we connected.
Not maybe. That was really special to me, though. I loved.
Special to me, yeah.
It was very nice. It was, I felt seen.
And heard. You
know, and heard.
And wanted.
And wanted. And caffeinated.
Yeah.
So.
But yeah, man, it was cool even in those few moments to learn about your story. And,
you
know, you definitely have a pretty cool, unique background, as a lot of us do, moving to Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we just go into, you know, where you're from and kind of walk us through, you know, growing up in Maine and the East Coast and then going to Berklee and...
Oh, dude, I'll talk your ear off all
day. So you were drumming since 3, right?
Yeah, so like my snarky answer to that is like, I started banging on pots and pans when I was like 2.5, 3. My parents got me a drum set when I was 3. Like, it was like a little paper head. I think I actually included a picture to like as a... Like an infant, like playing a drum set. But so like my stupid snarky answer is like, I don't remember not being a drummer, which like, and I don't mean to sound like a jerk, but like, I literally don't remember not being like, oh, it's John who doesn't stop playing drums.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of how it was for me.
Yeah.
Early on. Yeah.
But yeah. So like I started taking my parents, I'm the youngest of 4, and I started taking piano lessons when I was 5. And all my brothers and I, my parents made us take piano lessons when we were 5. And we had to stick with it for 2 years. And then if we hated it, which our piano teacher was weird, so I hated it. Like, meaning, like, she didn't instill the love of music in me. Like, right. Yeah. It was, like,
Cold technical.
It was exercise. Cold technical, which, you know, I'm a warm-blooded person, so I didn't love that.
Were your parents also musical? Like, is that why they wanted
They weren't.
They weren't, okay.
I think my mom sang at one point and played piano. My dad played trumpet in grade school. But, like, they just thought it was an extremely important skill to have as being a musician.
Love that.
I feel like sometimes, obviously, when a parent is a musician, there is a desire for the kids to do it too. Mm. But a lot of times they're like, yeah, but I'm not going to make them. Like,
right.
But a lot of non-musician parents are like, well, I wish that I was.
Vicariously, right?
Right. So, yeah, you got to do this. You got to do this thing for at least a little while. It's like, I mean, my mom made me try all these different sports, which I hated all of them, except for soccer. I liked soccer.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
But still. But, you love soccer too, right, Dan?
Not so much soccer. Oh, okay. I'm more into football. Oh, and then, this year I've been doing ultimate frisbee and volleyball.
Oh, cool.
Just like kind of, you know, recreational sports.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Mm-hmm. I know. I feel like you look like a soccer player. Maybe that's what
I played when I was very little, and then Little League baseball.
Nice.
And tennis too.
I was going to say, how long have you been playing tennis?
I've never taken formal lessons. I just love to play it. Just really just like the past 2 years, I've been pretty consistent with it.
I played tennis when I was a kid too. Yeah. It was a good time.
Nice.
But yeah, like, I don't know. I think the funniest thing about sports and music and like, it's hilarious how, and I understand like you gain so many good like social and people skills when you do these team sports or you learn these disciplines, right? But I remember seeing a meme a couple months ago and it was saying, isn't it funny that we're these things like playing music, we're told to practice them and do them and master them. And then when we get to 18, your parents are like, oh, no, you're not doing that as a career.
Right.
Well, no, you have to get a real job. Like, what was I doing
That's true.
10 years of my life.
You know? Why did I have to spend all that time on that thing? Yeah, thank God.
You sent me up to my room so many times to practice. You spent so much money on these lessons.
That's a good point.
But anyway, that being said, I was allowed to quit piano after 2 years. And then I was like, I want to take drums. So then I took drum lessons up until I went to college. Which was pretty cool.
I like how actually natural that transition is from piano to drums. Mm. Well, hand independent stuff.
Right.
Obviously, yeah. Piano is, I think by most people kind of, I mean, obviously it is a melodic instrument, but it is first and foremost percussion.
It is.
It's what it is.
It is. It is.
So it's. I've recently started taking formal piano lessons.
Oh, and cool.
This is so cool. I wish that I would have done that as a child. That would have been the move.
I mean, I think when I got to college, I had at least 5 professors tell me the most important instrument you can know is the piano. And I was like, shoot.
Yeah.
And like when I was in middle school, like, you know, when you start taking your formal instrument, like in 5th grade, or I don't know if that happened to you guys.
Yeah.
You get to choose an instrument. Well, I was
recorder, right?
Yep. Recorder. Uh-huh.
I came up at a different episode, right? You were bashing on the recorder.
Oh yeah. I'll bash the recorder all day long.
My elementary school music teacher, I found out about this years later. This never happened to me, but I found out years
later.
She's like
a world-renowned jazz recorder.
No. Recordist, if you will. She worked for the recorder concerts in front of all these parents. The kids who weren't cutting it, she would stuff their recorders with Kleenex.
Are you kidding me?
Wow. It's the worst thing in the world.
That's awful.
I love it. First of all,
that recorder, should be a thing.
An instrument which is utterly misnamed because no one has ever recorded
right.
anything with that trash instrument. If you play the recorder professionally, forgive me.
Reach out to us.
Correct.
The phone number is on the screen.
I'm happy to be shown that I'm wrong. If you can show me a great recording with a recorder, I would honestly love it. I have never heard that thing sound anything remotely like what you would call good.
But in middle school, when I like chose an instrument, I was like, man, I'm going to be bored playing like drums because I'm already like this amazing drummer. Not really, but like I already played drum set and I was like, I don't want to play just a snare drum.
Yeah.
So I started playing trumpet,
which
is funny because full circle, when I go to college, I go to a strictly classical school.
Oh.
And I've never played marimba. And so I was very far behind. And I wish I had stuck with the drums in middle school because I could have like gained that. Like I've had to work really hard to recognize like tones and ear training and theory because I didn't grow up with it. You know, yeah. I played a monophonic instrument and then I played drums. So it's like I never really dug into that.
So did you do like 2 years at Boston, 2 years at Berkeley, or how did that
split? That's a good question. I did 4 years at Boston University and got my degree in music ed.
Okay.
But like it was literally all classical. Like I got laughed at for playing drum set and jazz and like, which was weird because I was actually making money in college like playing. But I mean,
that's so odd.
I got some hurt there. Like I still got some stuff I got to work through.
Yeah. You doing like orchestra work or?
Yeah. And it's amazing. Some of the dudes I went to school with, guys and girls, have won competitions around the world playing marimba and stuff. Like, it's awesome. But yeah, so like I got done at Boston University and I was like, man, I really want to take a drum set. And so I did 3 semesters at Berkeley.
Okay.
And got to study with some like pretty amazing teachers and like learn jazz theory, which they didn't teach at Boston University. So.
I'm curious, do you remember what it was that, because it sounds like you were, you know, you just said you were making money, you were enjoying, you know, the classical route. What was it that kind of...
Oh, I'm sorry. I was making money playing drum set.
Oh, drum set. Okay.
While I was...
I got you. I thought,
while I was in the practice
room. That makes more sense.
Learning these etudes and like working out of Anthony Cerrone books.
So did that kind of inform, it's like, okay, this is more of a career decision.
Yeah. And like I had always... Like classical percussion was very difficult for me, and it taught me a lot of great techniques.
Oh, for sure, discipline, right?
Oh, 1,000%. But like drums, that was always my first love, and it still is. And so it was difficult. I mean, I think y'all know you're taking piano lessons. Like, you know, it's hard to go into a room and work at something that you're not naturally already good at. You know, like you don't have natural facility at.
It's simple physics. An object in motion tends to stay in motion. It's just, it's literally, it's inertia. You have to build that inertia. You have to get momentum going.
Right.
It's, yeah.
That's true.
But I actually want to circle back really quick.
Sure.
You said you got laughed at for playing drum set.
Yeah.
And that, first of all, it just makes me aware that, as you said, you're like, why am I getting laughed at? I'm making money doing this thing. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so interesting that people can be pretentious about anything because you get people who are, you're playing classical snare. That's great. Like, but I'm playing gigs and making money.
Right.
Or you're like, oh, you're playing gigs and making money. Well,
I'm
studying the marimba. Yeah. Like,
yeah, that's a good point.
Right.
What was your experience with that? Like, just give me a couple of.
Oh, 1,000%. Again, I think a lot of it for me was masked with like the frustration of it is difficult to walk in to a studio, as they call it, you know, with all these amazing players. And I know that I'm up to their level, but on a different instrument.
Right.
And it was something that they didn't see the need to know it and vice versa for me, because these people wanted to go win a job at, you know, in an orchestra. I mean, like the head of our percussion department was the principal timpanist for the BSO. And his salary at the BSO was $250,000 a year. Plus, he was the head of a studio at. So, like, that's. I feel like that's kind of the end goal for people who are classical musicians.
Yeah,
I don't know, right? But I feel like that's a pretty big one. Is you get a spot in a well-paying orchestra, and then you get to teach as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of guys or women, they'll move around. You're right. They'll audition for different orchestras a few years, and until you finally land that like. Career,
the big
settle down in a city and all that.
But it was interesting because again, like with their tail between their legs a little bit, maybe. But like I would give a lot of the people in the studio short drum set lessons because they would be going to these auditions, and if it was for like a pops group, they would need to know a little bit of drum set if they were doing whatever for the 4th of July or they were playing West Side Story or something. They need to know a little bit of drum set, but like that was it. Everything else was marimba, timpani. Which again is, I'm amazed at how great people like that are who pay such attention to detail.
Because
I don't pay that much attention to detail when it comes to, and that's what improvisation is, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of that free flow. But it was a very interesting experience for me, and I think it's given me a lot of good insight into like how I approach other musicians. And, like I would laugh about. I used to say to people who didn't live in cities that I wanted to live in, or do things that I wanted to do. I talked to them like they were crazy or like they were stupid. You know, like people were like, oh yeah, I'm moving out of LA when I wanted to move there. I'd be like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like that's where you need to be. Or like
yeah, right.
people are like, oh, you know, I might want to teach instead of playing. I'd be like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
One
yeah.
of my favorite expressions is say you don't know when you learn everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of that idea of like, man, all of us have our own experience doing things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why this is so great because you get to sit down and hear other people's experiences.
Yeah.
In Agreed. A world that we're all living in. You know? Mm-hmm.
Dude, that's 100%. Why I love doing
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the best, aside from playing the drums.
Right.
This is my favorite thing. I love this.
Yeah.
Aw.
So sweet. It was a really interesting experience going through all that and then getting to go to Berkeley and like studying with some of the best teachers I've ever yeah. been around. You know,
yeah.
like, do y'all know who the band Winger is?
Yes. Yeah.
So I was walking down the hall one day and Rod Morgenstein was next to me and I was like, what? Like, I had Mike Mangini.
Or Dixie Dregs.
That was
yeah. his band with Steve Morse.
See, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I gotta look that up.
Yeah,
no, my bad.
Man.
See, I got homework now.
That top.
There's always homework
sick,
after these.
Homework. Sick fusion with shredding fiddle. Like
my gosh.
Dixie fusion. I love the
Mind
Dixie
Dregs.
Oh, dude.
Yeah, I gotta check that out.
Rod's a businessman.
But like, and like, I took a class with Mike Mangini before,
yeah.
literally the semester wow. before he joined Dream Theater. So it was kind of cool. He was like, I'm not going to be here next semester and I can't tell you why. And we were like, oh, okay.
What was it like, Sonny? I didn't even know he was a teacher. What was
he
it like with him?
Freakishly smart.
Yeah.
Like, he's amazing.
He's super
I just
smart.
Know him as a kick-ass drummer that he is.
Well, here's the interesting part about him is he's so smart and he's so, like, interested in why things happen.
Yes.
But, like, he knows, like, with his method books, he knows what muscles in, like, are in your forearm and how to, like, exercise them correctly and, like, perfect technique to make sure that you can play this. And it's not one of these, like, hey, just do it because you do it. It's
yes.
like, no, you
he
do know, this.
He knows exactly why what he is doing does what it does.
Oh, it's fascinating to me.
Have you read his books, man?
No, I haven't.
Oh, for sure. At least get the first one.
Yeah.
That's my homework.
That's your homework. Yeah, it answers a lot of questions. Yeah, the guy's got a giant freaking brain. Yeah.
He does.
I love
He's always
method.
Thinking. And
yeah.
like, and well, that was the cool thing. I was a Pearl guy for a couple of years, and I loved the collaboration that he had with Pearl, coming out with like the Demon Drive and
yeah.
like all these crazy things for the drum set that like you knew, and just from talking to him, he was like, "This is perfect because." Like, you need these ball bearings in this because.
Yeah.
And you're like, what?
You know, he's been a true pioneer for the brand, for sure.
He really has, yeah.
It's pretty cool.
But, like, yeah, he's a crazy, crazy dude and very nice, extremely nice.
He seems like a complete sweetheart. Also, I love the way he says Horacio Hernandez. Horacio!
Because he's a Boston
yeah.
dude.
Oh, my God.
He grew up in South Bay. Horacio Hernandez.
Have you ever heard him tell the story of how he learned to play double strokes on the bass drum?
No.
Nope.
He had a dream about Virgil Donati. Yeah, he's like, Virgil was always shredding those doubles. And he was like, I had a dream that Virgil was sitting on the drumometer and he was playing the doubles. And he looked at me and he goes, you're never going to learn this. You'll never get it. He was playing at such speed. I knew he was going to destroy the drumometer and I'd never learn it. He goes, and I woke up and I knew how to play it.
Like, oh my God.
That's like a prophetic dream. Right
wow. Is that like what we have to look forward to? I'm going to have dreams of Nate just playing in 17. Like you'll never do this.
And then you'll wake up.
I wake up sweating.
I can do this.
Jeez. That's the drummer future for us here.
Man. No, that, yeah, he's a wild dude. And
so you spent a semester with him?
Yes. It was a double bass lab.
Okay.
Let's go.
Let's talk.
I don't own a double bass drum pedal anymore, so that's a little...
What were your big takeaways from that experience?
Oh, my goodness.
As a guy now who I haven't historically been a big double bass guy, but mm-hmm. now playing so much prog metal...
Do you?
Yes.
Wow.
That's not my bread and butter.
That's my...
Yeah, that's
okay.
what I'm...
Let's go.
Yeah. I'm having to focus in on that pretty hard.
I'll send you some exercises.
Oh, man.
Two of the biggest things I took away from him, one was obviously the thirst for knowledge of, like, mm-hmm. why does this happen? Why? And I've always been a huge gear nerd, and I feel bad for poor Dan over here because literally every time we grab coffee, I, like, jump down his throat about, like, gear. Cause I'm like, you work at Pearl. Like, let's talk.
Yeah, what's coming
drum
out?
Gear. Like yeah. Let's talk. You know, all my favorite was, you know, but I feel like all I do is talk about
it. I love it too.
But that being said, the second biggest thing I took away from him was ambidexterity. Hmm. And like, you should be able to do what you can with your right, with your left, and vice versa. And like, a lot of the exercises we learned in his class were left hand lead. Or like left foot lead really is what it
right.
is. So make the left foot your constant. And then, you know, there's this one that was really good. It was filling in 30-second notes. But the left foot is the constant.
Mm-hmm.
And then you fill in all the other notes, like the odd notes of the 30-second note with your right foot.
Nice.
And then you start doing patterns with your hands. And it's like.
Yeah, buddy.
So it's kind of the same way I felt with. Y'all know who JoJo Mayer is.
Of course, yeah.
One of my faves.
What's his video, the Weapons of
Something? Oh, yeah, Secret Weapons, the Modern Drummer. Yeah.
My goodness, those are my favorites. Like, I learned so much about, like, the molar stroke from him.
Yeah.
But what I thought was so cool is, especially with the second DVD, because the first one was, like, technique, the second one was conceptual.
Yeah.
And so he would, like, show you a technique, and you'd be like, oh, I got this. Like, I did it three times with my,
mm-hmm.
and then he would just do it at like an unbelievable, ungodly speed.
Yes.
Yeah. And you're just with no effort. And you're like, oh, cool. You'll never be able to do this.
Right. Well, yeah. There's something that I didn't personally hear him say. Someone else told me, my buddy Rob, who plays for a band called Icarus the Owl. He said,
I know that band.
Yeah. Little Portland. I've heard of them, yeah. They're sick. Math. Rock.
Right.
Math meets post-hardcore, I guess, whatever. I don't know what you call them.
Post-math.
Yeah, post-math.
What?
All the genres are so confused to me at this point. I don't even know what's what. But
call jazz.
He was saying that he heard JoJo say, he's like, I could not practice or play the drums for 6 months and it wouldn't make a difference. He's like, my technique would be identical.
Gosh.
So whatever he's done has allowed him to maintain
that.
Jeez. Always. I'm like,
well, because it's not so much technique, right? It's same thing with Mangini. Like, it's using, I mean, it's technique, but it's learning to use momentum and gravity to your advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that anywhere, right? Like, it's like the difference between lifting weights and using a lever.
You know?
Anyone can do that, right? Like, pull down the lever and.
Right.
Two guests ago, Marcus Finney, we had a really interesting discussion where he talked about how technique is like, okay, you can play longer, like longevity, right?
Mm.
And, you know, you're not going to have all these injuries, but then it's like, well, are you getting the sound that you want? I mean, you see all these drummers like doing what might look like bad technique or it looks weird, but like,
right.
You know, they're blowing up on YouTube and they're making really cool things. And
they sound great. Well, that's like, okay. And the first person I think of is Brad Wilk from Rage Against the Machine
because
his groove feels so freaking deep.
Yep.
But when you watch him play, he looks kind of stiff.
Yeah.
He has this like very,
right.
I'm like, oh, that's really actually kind of, that's not what
I wrote a picture.
Yeah.
Well, my favorite with that was, man, the first time, and I have all the respect and love for this drummer, but like the first time I ever attempted to play the opening fill to Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
That, I have two moments that are like ingrained in my brain. That and the first time I ever took this drum set lab with this drummer named Larry Finn at Berkeley. And he was the first drummer I ever heard play live where he just played a groove. And I was like, oh, you're somebody.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's just so solid and like tight.
The pocket is.
And you're like, oh, you're not just like, you didn't learn to play drums in your garage.
Yeah.
And still play there. But like playing that fill that Smells Like Teen Spirit, it sounds like an easy fill. Then you go to play and you're like, nope.
Yeah, getting that
one up.
Yeah, getting that right feel wise.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Which is like, and that's what Dave Grohl is in a nutshell, right?
Yeah,
like, you listen through the Them Crooked Vultures album.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wonder if he's up to anything these days. Has he done anything since Nirvana?
A couple things.
Yeah.
Reinvented rock and roll three times.
Yeah. Like, no big deal. Just the,
you know,
probably the greatest living rock star. That's my hot
take. Yeah.
That's correct.
Not that many people would argue that with you. So.
I would agree with that. But I think you're totally right. It is obviously technique, I think, is very important, but like it's also how you play and what you sound like.
Yeah.
And that's what's so interesting, though, I think about kind of like the over, and I'll keep this hot take short, but like the over-education of America.
Hmm.
Like
don't bother keeping it short, man.
I got a, and this will tell you how I think and how I have been in my life, but yeah. I got demanded by an MD one time when I was in LA to read this book called The Inner Game of Tennis.
Yeah, oh, I have that book.
Great book.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's essentially about like your ego, which we all have an ego, but it's about learning to like quiet it. And this is another thing that Mangini taught us too, which is really interesting. But the idea that, so you have two egos, right? You have a good and a bad. Mm-hmm. You have the bad ego that tells you you're terrible. You have the good ego that tells you you're killing it. And so if you're playing, and I think this is so fascinating, if you're playing and you like mess something up, you rush a fill, you know, do something, drop a stick, every second your bad ego is telling you, you suck, or like, oh, you messed up. Like, oh no. In my case, like everyone on stage hates you now. Like,
right.
That is every second that you're doing that, your brain is not focusing on what you're playing, so right. You probably mess up again.
It happened to me last night a little
bit. Did it really?
Well, I didn't have any kind of major thing, but it was like a part that I was like, I went to double time.
Yeah.
And it was not the right time for it. So like the audience probably didn't know, but like the guitar player was like, nope, not yet.
Yeah.
And then I'm like in my head, I'm like, all right, just, yeah, I was trying to quiet that right. negative voice.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm fine. Like,
no one's going to die.
It's interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, it's funny, like stuff like that can derail you. Uh-huh. You're like, oh man, oh, I'm just so embarrassed by that thing. Or you can just be like, that was funny.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's eventually like, I think I have enough awareness from reading that book as well. Just like, okay, just keep going, like quiet it down. And,
well, and in that book, in the same way, like if you're killing it, if you nail the double time, if you nail this insane fill and people like look at you or whatever, then every second that your brain is like, nice, you're not thinking about what you're playing.
Right.
So you're probably going to mess up. So it's like quieting those and focusing on what you're playing.
Well, it's funny because I had not done that in rehearsal. So I made it a funny thing for me. I was like, that's so funny, Dan. Like you never did that, but now in the gig you did it.
Yeah.
That's funny. Like, that's all. It's okay.
Well,
like,
and also because we can't go back and change the past, right?
We and the rest of the gig, I crushed it because I immediately got past it.
You know? Dude, heck yeah.
So.
No, I love that. And it's also like, man, some of the most crazy things can come out of you messing up, right? So I'm like, if you're worried about making a mistake, I feel like that wall goes up and at least for me, creativity is gone.
Yes.
I have to play it just like the part. And if I mess up, then if I make a face at anyone, if I fool around, and it's like, no, like have fun with it.
Yeah.
Crush it.
That's, you know what? Okay. So two people gave me a very similar message to that. And that, well, there've been a variety of people, but really specifically, you know who Mike Mitchell is?
Oh, I know that name.
He's a sick, sick, sick drummer. He played for Stanley Clarke. Plays with Sean Martin and a group called Spirit Fingers. Anyway, freaking crazy drummer. And then he has his own project. He's just called Black Dynamite.
Nice.
But I took the lesson with him and he was talking about getting, I was like, so dude, how is it you have your creativity on the set is like unlimited. It's just like, it never stops. And he's like, well, you know, he's like, are you familiar with, IDGAF? He's like,
I did that in my head.
Yeah. I was yes I am. He goes, cool. That's like kind of my life mantra. I was like, right on. I like that. Okay. He goes, it actually gets me in trouble sometimes because that's just how I am. I just am naturally that way. He goes, I actually don't think enough about things. But he was like, dude, he talked about playing with Stanley. And he said, one night I was playing and I did something I didn't really like. And I got it at the end of the gig. I was like, yeah, man, sorry. You know, I was really thinking about that. I really just didn't like that. And he was kind of down on himself. And then he goes, Stanley got mad at me. He goes, man, shut up. He's like, first of all, I didn't even notice you messed up. No one in the band noticed. No one in the audience noticed. And now you're ruining my vibe.
Now you're ruining my vibe.
What are you doing? Like, what are you doing? He goes, so I never did that again. Or like for the rest of the time.
Wow.
He's like, I occupy my brain with what the band is doing. He's like, he goes, I'm thinking about how much I like the groove the bass player is playing. And then my mentor kind of echoed that. He was like, yeah, man, you don't want to be consciously thinking about what you're playing.
Right.
Because your conscious brain can make like something like 2 or 3 decisions a second, whereas your subconscious can make something like 140.
Seriously?
He's like, so you ask yourself, what amount of brain power do you want? Do you want to be able to make 2 or 140 decisions?
Right.
Like, put your conscious brain, occupy your conscious brain with the band.
Yeah.
And that's where your conscious brain is on the music, and then your subconscious can just play.
And doesn't that make it more musical too?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because then you're having a conversation. You're not like,
right.
Okay, I'm going to say the word the next.
Exactly.
And probably, yeah. And.
Yeah.
You know, like it's,
right.
No, right, you have a conversation.
Right. And, well, and then when do you, in speaking, like when you're meeting a person for the first time, when do you mess up? When you're like really consciously aware of
what you're about. I'm going to introduce myself.
Oh, my name is... I promise I'm not an idiot most of the time.
Oh, my God.
That's so true. Man, that's awesome. I really like that.
Yeah,
I like that a lot.
That you got me thinking about that. I was,
while you guys were saying that too, just to kind of also bring it back to sports, like you watch football at all?
Okay, so I used to. Hockey and baseball are my like.
Okay. Jams. Well, it applies to
you. I know about football.
Yeah, you look like you like hockey.
I wish I'd played it. I never did, but I love watching it.
But you have the build of someone who enjoys hockey.
100%.
I'm going to start telling people, you know what?
I look like a
whatever. Whatever player. No, you look like you enjoy it.
You look like you watch that sport. Yeah. Continue.
No, you're good. So like, you know, when a quarterback, or this could apply to any athlete, but I'm thinking of the NFL, you know, when a quarterback throws like a bad ball and in the middle of the down, right, the series, you know, what do? The teammates tell them like, you're good, like, you know, hand on your back,
right.
You know, just keep going, like, don't worry about it, get him. And then once they get to the sidelines, what's the first thing they do, right? You'll see him with the iPad, with the coach, and they analyze like, okay, now what actually went wrong?
Yep.
I feel like we could do that as music. Maybe you guys do. I know for me, like thinking back to the gig that I just had, it's like, okay, in the moment I got past it, but now let me go back and figure out, okay, why did that actually happen? Was it nerves? Did I really just not understand the form of the song? Let's figure out why.
Yes.
Let's not ignore it. History repeats itself, right? It's probably going to happen again.
Yes.
So
being critical is not for while you're actually doing the thing. That is a separate time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and that's honestly why I don't know about y'all, but like, I'm also not at the level right now where I have a drum tech or anything like that. I really value my setup and teardown time for that reason. And that's kind of like one of the reasons why I don't love the like cattle call gigs where it's like, quick, hurry up, put your bass drum pedal and your snare and your cymbals on here. We're late. Come on. We got to go. Like, or okay, you're done. Like, get off the stage so the next person can get up. Because I love that time of like reflection. Or even before a gig, I like to find a quiet spot, whether that's setting my drums up or, you know, in a corner and like set myself up for. And I had a teacher at Berkeley. His name was Dave DiCenzo.
Huh.
And he's my favorite teacher I've ever had.
Yeah. He's one of my favorite drummers of all time. Yeah.
So his big thing was consistency. And like, how do you, because it killed me in my early 20s, sitting down at a gig, having a good gig, and the next night it was trash.
Yeah.
And being like, have I ever touched a drum set before? But he taught like consistency and like setting yourself up, sitting correctly so that you sit the same way, your posture is good night in and night out. And like, same thing with like your grip, which that is a technique thing that I think is important. But he always said, find a time before you play to go over things. Cool. This is a problem spot in the song. Don't do this. Make sure wait that extra measure before you do this.
Yeah.
Or like, okay, cool. The transition is going to be like this, like talking point here. And just like go through that stuff in your head.
Yeah.
And then kind of like an exit interview after the gig.
Yeah. That's,
you know,
that's
being like, you know, that didn't work out so well. Maybe don't do that next time.
Yeah.
Or like,
but it's all introspect. It's all just you. It's not like you're talking to other band members.
Exactly.
So you really value that time after a gig.
Yeah.
Just to kind of have some peace and quiet.
And that's why I really love, and I don't mean for this to sound rude, I love when people grant me that.
Yeah.
And you don't have people being like, oh, can I help you? No, really, let me help you. And then they start like breaking your stands down and putting them in your back. You're like, really? Like, I need this time. Yeah,
please don't touch my things.
I will say I had the nicest, I played outside, Nate saw me, outside the Ryman. So
last night.
I did not play the Ryman, but it was like the sidewalk session thing they were doing before. It was before Jason Isbell.
Which looks really cool, yeah.
It was great. It was the perfect night for it. Anyway, one of the stagehands, literally like I was parked right outside and he was like super friendly and he grabbed like all of my hardware.
Awesome.
I was like, dude, thank you so much. Like that's super helpful. Cause it was kind of a, kind of a rush thing. They were like, all right, you guys have 15 minutes to go.
My goodness.
And the stage was small and everyone was kind of stressing. And that was really nice.
Oh, that's awesome.
But no, I do understand what you're saying. And especially after the gig, I was like, all right.
Right.
Let me, I'll take care of it. And
yeah,
you know, thank you. But I'm sure you have your things. I have my things. And
yeah.
You know.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Do you guys have any technique things that you like really love? That you like things that you're like, oh man, like, yeah, this is really important to me. And or like was really hard. The thing that I always like to remember technique wise, and now we're talking about technique, but like I always have to remind myself that everything we started doing at the beginning was difficult.
Right.
And so you'll be good at it one day. But like I can get discouraged sometimes when I'm doing something new. It's like, oh man, like I'm not getting it. And it's like, wait. It took me a while to learn how to walk, right?
Hmm. Yeah,
it's good perspective. 14 years, you know? No, just kidding. But,
real late bloomer.
Yeah.
But like mine, for instance, was like, I remember in with Dave DiCenzo, him and Mike Mangini were both very adamant about teaching me to play double heel up all the time. Mm. And it was really difficult for me to learn that. But yeah. Now that's what I do, and I think it's very important.
Yeah.
But I don't know, anything... Y'all.
Something that comes to mind for me is like we were talking about like just posture and just like having the kit set up very ergonomically.
Sure.
And especially in those rush settings, not just throwing the, you know, the snare this high and whatever angle, just playing, but like having it, like taking the extra 4 minutes, like the sound guys can wait, the band can wait. Like I need to be comfortable.
Right.
So that's something I've been focusing on more recently.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
For me, I would say... One of the things I value and have learned to value in the last few years especially is hitting hard. I realized that the guys that I liked, the sound that I was digging. So a few years back, let's see, when I was 18, I guess.
Okay.
That's been a few years now.
4 years?
Yeah. Well, a few more than that. I was at NAMM and I encountered certain players and I saw these little flyers going out for something called Gospel Chops. And I got really into that thing. And then I came to realize some years back now that those guys were hitting really hard, really hard. And getting not like
but with
not,
good technique.
With good, exactly. They weren't like digging it. The stick was breathing out of the drum, but they were hitting hard.
You can feel the kick drum of the snare in your heart.
Right. And I was like, there was something when I was copying those, because I kind of naturally played light at the beginning of my first years. I was a very light touch. And I learned that there was something that was missing when I was going for that sound. I'm like, why don't I sound that dope?
Right.
Because...
I wasn't
hitting hard enough. And I'm like, and then you listen to like Chris Coleman. That dude is he's just lighting them up. Like if you watch him like chatting with other drummers, he could play the same thing and just twice as loud. And you go, well, you just like,
you won.
Yeah. It wasn't even necessarily a competition, but you won.
You won.
You won the game. Yeah. I'm like wow. Gosh, it just sounds like a thunder when he's playing. So yeah, that's, I've learned to really, really value playing very hard, but with very good technique, like letting it breathe. But God, it makes such a difference.
So to give you an example of not good technique, I played a gig. It must have been, it was in July, I think, but it was in Chattanooga, and I'm not going to name any names, but a band was opening up for us, and the drummer put on an amazing show, right? Insanely good and very entertaining. It was like standing on his drum seat and like doing all this cool stuff. I walk up after the show and he was talking about how he had like really like it was important to hit hard but have good technique. And I was like, yeah, I totally agree. I walk up after they play and we're getting ready to play. And the back line, we had a back line kit. It was a DW, awesome, fresh Remo heads on it. You're ambassadors, so they are thin. Mm-hmm. But I walk up and the drum heads are unusable. Like concave.
Wow.
Unusable. And they had already left.
Jeez.
And I was like, are you serious? Like,
whoa.
Excuse me. Yeah. Like, that's just rude.
Yeah.
I couldn't use my toms for the gig. I used kick, snare, cymbals, fun thing to try anyway. But like, I was like, are you serious?
Well, that's ridiculous.
Are you really going to like,
yeah.
You watch like a, you know, yeah, you watch like a Chris Coleman or somebody, or, you know.
Yeah.
they hit hard, but like their heads last.
Yes.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah, if you're, right. yeah, that's going to happen if one, if you're playing with like freaking marching sticks or something, or you've got fat sticks with the tiny little bead acorns. And then you're like, okay, that'll happen.
Yeah.
But otherwise, don't dig your damn sticks into the head. And that, thank God, that was something that my first teacher did drill into me. He was like, you know, Nathan, some drummers like to play and they'll play through the drum. And then he's Welsh. He's like, really dig the stick into the drum head. But he's like, you want to let it breathe? really drilled that into my brain. I'm like, so whenever I would see that happen, I'm like, yeah, that's not good.
Yeah.
I'll even like be maybe a little too rude about it. Be like, yeah, you see what you're doing there? Yeah. Don't fucking do that.
See that? Yeah. Not
they
that.
They tell people how he feels.
Yeah.
Also, I don't know who you're referencing, but I'm sure the accent was spot on.
Yeah. That was really good, I bet.
Impersonation.
Are you listening, Nathan? I have an Altoid. Yeah, every time. Whenever you could tell I was same unfocused, with like, Altoid. Yeah.
The Wim Hof that we were doing with Drew. That was the same thing.
What's that you said? You want to learn how to play drums, but you don't know where to begin? Let me humbly suggest to you that you head on down to Music Lab Nashville and you talk to their crew of fantastic teachers and you jump on in and start your music journey right there. Don't want to learn drums? Want to learn guitar? Ukulele? Mandolin? Trumpet? Vocals? Keys? Sitar? Maybe not sitar, but all that other stuff for sure. Visit nashville.musiclab.co to learn more and sign up for a free trial lesson.
Let's transition a little bit into your journey.
Yes.
In your bio, like you referred to that you were called to Nashville.
Yeah.
So you moved to LA in 2014.
Yes.
I guess briefly walk us through that transition and then, you know, your move to Nashville.
I love that. Okay, cool. So I was in Boston for 10 years. You know, I kind of found the ceiling there is, it's an education town. So like the ceiling there is kind of low for playing. It's really, really difficult to play full time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'd always wanted to live in LA. That was like LA or bust, man. I got ready to move there. I already had a brother who lived out there. So I was getting ready to move out there. And funny enough, I had a lot of people tell me like, hey, you should check out Nashville. And I was like, nah, palm trees, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was really funny because I had, when I was moving my brother out to LA, this was around 2010, we had spent one night in Nashville, which now I know that's not enough time. But we spent one night in Nashville. We stayed at the Comfort Inn right at the top of Demumbrian and walked down. And man, it's funny because that was a very different Broadway than today. So it was very interesting. It really freaked me out. Because I walked in and we talked to a couple of musicians when they were on break. And they were like, we are playing for tips. And this is a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
They're like, we do not get paid unless you put money in our jar. And I knew how small Nashville was. And I was like, I'm not doing that.
We also going to ask like what your mindset was in that point in your life. Like, were you already sort of like, okay, I'm going to be a full-time drummer.
Yeah.
Going to LA.
Yep.
So was Nashville kind of like, oh, crap, like, I really need to go somewhere else? Or like, did it give you inspiration to figure it out, I guess?
It freaked me out because I was like, it's so small. I already know that I'm behind the curve. Everyone is when it comes to like, if your dream, if you're striving is to be a professional musician and only play music and like get the best gig in the world, I don't know, whatever. it's already the odds are stacked against you. So that scared me. So I moved to LA. I was really excited about it. And I remember I had a couple of friends through my brother who lived out there. And one of the first weeks I was there, my friend and I went on a hike, which in LA, a hike is just like walking up a paved path. Right. You know, there's some pretty hard hikes, but like, you know, pretty much people are just walking up roads. And he was like, cool. So you live in LA now? He's like, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, I really want to be a touring drummer. I didn't know what that meant, but I was like, I wanted to tour and make money doing it. And then, I don't know, like when I'm in town, like, I don't know, be a session drummer maybe. And he goes, okay, well, the touring thing is Nashville, so you picked the wrong city. And the studio thing, like, they don't really do that much these days. It's mostly like in your bedroom or like programming for MIDI. And I was like, cool.
Right on.
I made a huge mistake.
I see now that I have made an error. Right?
Now, wait. Yeah. So I was there for 5 years, but like I played a lot in theme parks, which is like, that is LA's Broadway.
Huh. Yes.
I didn't realize
playing,
that.
Playing at like Disneyland and Universal Studios. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, Knott's Berry Farm. They got a ton.
Was that drum set, or were you doing like marching snare?
I was doing drum set. I did marching snare for one show, or marching bass drum for one show.
Nice.
And then I played like Dixieland in one show for about 4 years. But it was like stand-up snare drum with a ride cymbal and like a cowbell and just like playing jazz.
Yeah.
That paid for a lot of my bills when I was out there, which was great. The funny thing, and that you're like a lot of corporate stuff, the interesting thing about touring out there, and of course people do it because it's a huge touring city, right?
Right.
But the difficult part is, like in Nashville, you can do a weekend run anywhere, right?
Yes.
LA, you got to fly somewhere, or the closest places to go that isn't actual LA is like San Diego, Phoenix, Arizona.
I was going to say Arizona.
Yeah. You know, San Fran, which terrifying city, or like Vegas.
True.
And then the next city you hit is like Colorado, like Denver, you know, like it's, so it's really hard to tour if you're not flying. And if you're flying, then you're on a pretty big gig, right?
Like, right.
But
so what I'm hearing is there's not a lot of like middle ground.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas here, like you can get a van with some buddies and it'd still be a good gig, but it's not like the budget is more comfortable.
Exactly.
And yeah. we're just gonna take a little day drive to Ohio and like you're gonna make a few hundred bucks. So like
1,000%.
Sick.
1,000%.
Okay.
Awesome. I'm in.
So, and LA was a lot, I want to say more cutthroat in the sense that it's so expensive to live out there.
Yes.
And the interesting part, and again, this is only my experience. You know, we all only have our experiences.
Yep.
I like to joke that in Nashville, the way people size you up is they ask who you play for.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that like, oh, your name is Dan. Who do you play for? And the second that you say someone's name, they're the quickest to be like, don't know who that is.
Yep.
And it's like, be gone. You know, like, So my joke is whenever people ask me, I just say, and no one you've ever heard of.
Yeah.
You know, it's just one of those like, it doesn't matter.
You get on top
of it.
I'm nobody.
Yeah, I'm nobody.
Yeah.
And that's cool.
Yeah.
You know.
And the people that stick around after that are the homies.
Right.
Yeah.
You're so right about that. I'm always, in my experience, it hasn't necessarily been super negative, but it's just been like, I'm finding myself saying, well, and I guess I have more of a unique situation, like having the 9-to-5 gig at Pearl. And it's like, well, I freelance. It's like, oh, you in a band? Well, not really. Like, I have some consistent gigs.
Right.
And you probably haven't. Like, they're not big acts.
Show me a song on Spotify.
Yeah, like, right.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well.
When as soon as they hear that I'm, like, playing Prague, they're like, cool.
Yeah.
Later, nerd. Yeah.
But, like, but my challenge to anyone listening and to y'all and myself as well is, like, I've made sure to choose my introductions wisely. And like when I'm getting to know somebody, asking the right questions, because in my opinion, sometimes they're genuine when people really want to know who you play for.
Yeah.
But a lot of times that question is meant to cut down.
It's
meant to elevate themselves because maybe they're insecure or worried about who they're playing for. So the question is meant to be like, it's meant to assert dominance, right?
Yeah. It's the too firm handshake.
Exactly.
Like, what are you doing?
Come on, man. Like, I use my hands.
Yeah.
But so what that was in LA was people asking me or asking you if you played music full time.
Yeah.
And the idea was if you didn't play music full time, then it was like, cool, you're not good enough to make it only play music. We're not going to talk anymore.
Wow.
So like when I moved out to LA for the first year, I worked at DW. And it was an amazing experience. And
talk to us a little bit about that.
Oh, my goodness.
How'd you get that gig?
What
were you doing
there? There's an amazing drum shop in Maine, Portland, Maine, called The Drum Shop.
Yeah, I know those guys.
And it's Chris Dielman owns it. I started taking lessons there when I was 7 from a guy named Phil Verrill. And that's what got me started. And I would literally, every week, just come in before and after lessons and ask questions and just, why does this drum sound different? Why? What kind of wood is it made out of? You know, what cymbals are these? Why is this more expensive? And I got a job working there when I was 15. And so I worked at the drum shop through up until I went to college. And then when I came back for in between summers, I'd work there. And so I was literally 2 months new to LA, hemorrhaging money, like waiting for the phone to ring, which is because I moved like cold. I didn't have any work set up.
Yeah.
And I got a call from him. It was a week before NAMM. And he goes, hey, do you want to work at DW? And I was like, yeah, sure.
What drummer wouldn't, for any brand, be like, tell me more.
Right.
Well, yeah. And so I was like, okay. And he goes, come to NAMM. We'll get you in for free. And then go meet with so-and-so. His name is Scott Mundy. He doesn't work there anymore, but go meet with him and, let us know what you think and whatever. So I went and I went back behind the curtain at NAMM and at the DW booth. And they invited me to come to the factory the next day. So I went out and they called me on my way home and they were like, if you want to work here, like, we'd love to have you. The scary thing was Oxnard, which is where DW is 60 miles north of LA.
Hmm.
Not minutes, miles.
Miles.
So that would be
that
an hour and a half to 3 hours
each
way. Ooh.
But it was an amazing, it was funny because I joked, I accidentally told the upcoming CEO, Chris Lombardi, who's Don Lombardi's son.
Right.
I didn't know who he was. We go out for this because I started working there when DW acquired all the brands.
Right.
Right.
Gretsch, Toca, LP, Cat, Ovation Guitars. And we're out to dinner or lunch with everybody. And they were just, we were talking about drums. And I was like, I was jazzed about DW because I took their factory tour, which if you're ever in Oxnard, take their factory tour. It's free and it's amazing. But I was like talking to people and I go, yeah, it's so funny. Like I've been selling DW drums my whole life. I said, I always thought they were overpriced and overrated.
Yeah.
And everyone just stopped and looked at this guy and he goes, Where did you guys get this kid? And I was like, no, wait, I understand now. I was those drums are worth every penny, if not more, because they're handmade. The Performance Series, Collector Series, handmade in California. Mm. The company's extremely family oriented. I know they're owned by Roland now, but extremely family oriented. You know, there were so many people that I worked with whose cousins and brothers and sisters worked in the machine shop or worked, and they'd been there since the beginning. And so it's extremely cool. Which was really neat. But so that was a really, really awesome experience to get to
sounds like it.
Start there. And then after a year, I got too busy playing and left. But it was a big source of embarrassment for me to tell people I work at a drum company during the day. And I got that I just turned away.
Yeah. Honestly, I kind of experienced that a little bit here myself.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's more like, oh, sweet, we work for Pearl. But it's, replace Pearl with any day job. It's oh, you're not doing this full time. What's wrong with you or why?
Right.
Why are you here?
Right.
What's going on? Even though the question I feel like it should be is what do you, tell me more about your story. Yeah. I'm not going to immediately judge you on the artist that you play for.
Do you love it? Exactly. Right. No, I totally agree. And so I think I think at the end of the day, it's all just insecurity,
Well, imagine telling them that you worked at a hot dog stand, which I did. I worked for Daddy's Dogs for 2.5 years. So people would be like, hey, dude, who are you? Because I'd say I played drums. You have a card or anything? Oh, no, but I got an Instagram. All right, let me check it out. Oh, sick. You can play. Okay. Yeah. What are you playing for? Yeah. Oh, no, buddy. I work at a hot dog stand.
Buns and wieners.
Yeah.
They're Brooks and
Dunn. Wait, what?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, let me know if you need somebody.
Yeah, right.
Man, that also being said, I think everyone at some point in their life needs to work for the service industry and the retail industry.
I could not agree more.
I love that. Yeah.
And this is not a dig at anybody. But I remember Thomas Pridgen saying in an interview that he was like, I never wanted to have a regular job. So I practiced really hard so that I would never have to do that. And that's cool. But I think it would have benefited him personally to have had a regular person job at some point because it did benefit me.
100%.
I learned so much about human interaction and about how other people feel about this.
Yeah.
I when I go into a restaurant, I feel differently about it now than I did before having that kind of job. I'm like, it's a totally different experience. I know what the people in the back room are thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, if I have to send food back, I know exactly the thought process. I know how to do it without being a dick.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well. And if I may.
You may.
Thank you. I'm also
proceeds to say some horrible racist stuff.
No, you may not. Like, you may
no,
not.
No, never
not.
Mind.
Can I take that back?
Oh my God.
No, I'm so I'm and not to get like all ethereal on y'all, but like I'm very into right now and just fascinated with realizing the timing that we're in, that we are exactly where we're supposed to be at this moment. And there's a great quote I heard. It said, if you truly believe that there is a plan for you, right? And that like you are exactly where you need to be at this moment, then you are not any better than any other person. And no one is better than you.
Yeah.
And so it's the idea of like, man, like I really enjoy the bands I'm playing for right now. I really enjoy the other jobs that I'm doing. You know, when I'm teaching drum lessons or substitute teaching or doing whatever, I love what I'm doing. So like, who cares?
Yeah.
Like, and working at a hot dog stand, working at a, you know, at Pearl, which is an awesome company, like heck, serving coffee at a dope coffee place. Like it all gives us perspective and it makes us who we are. And it's teaching us what we need to learn.
Dude, so that's really well said.
Thank you. And it's funny because if you limit yourself, and this is what I learned when I moved to Nashville, if you limit yourself and only stay in the box that you want to stay in, then I think you're going to be out of touch.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right?
And that's for everything in life.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. Literally broaden your horizons.
One of my favorite quotes, do y'all like Finding Nemo? I love Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
That is one of the oddly wisest movies I've ever watched.
Right.
You're angry with me on this one.
Yeah, I'm waiting for this because I've seen it like once.
Okay. Man, do I have a story for you. Anyway.
So one of the many amazing scenes in this movie that I think are just so like incredibly wise if you actually like dig into it.
The first one, right? Because there's
one,
two now.
Yeah, it's two now.
Finding Dory or whatever.
I haven't watched that one enough to be like, to find it. But like Finding Nemo, oh my goodness. There's this one spot where Marlin, the clownfish who's the dad, says, he goes, when Nemo is lost, because the name of the movie, when Nemo is lost and he goes, I promised him I would never let anything happen to him.
Yeah.
And then Dory goes, oh, that's funny. And he goes, why? And she goes, well, if nothing ever happened to him, then nothing would ever happen to him.
Yeah.
Right.
Boom.
Boom.
Yeah.
Right? Like we learn so much more in the valleys than we do the peaks.
Right.
In the crappy moments of our life that we think, what am I doing? Like, why did I move here? Why did I do X, Y, and Z? You learn the most there than when you're blinded with pride, being like, I killed this. I deserve this job.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a great comparison, but,
I love that. That is a great line, and that was such a good moment in that movie. And both that and the thing you said previously reminded me of a lyric from a Punch Brothers song, which is funny because this has come up a couple times in the last couple of days. Do you know the Punch Brothers, first of all?
A little bit.
Man, check them out.
I got more homework, right?
Amazing band. Chris Thiele, almost certainly the greatest mandolin player of all time.
Okay.
But there's the song called Little Lights. He says, at the last lyrics in the song say, guide us back to where we are from where we want to be. Like, that was so, I know. I was like, whoa.
That's good. I'm thinking about it more and I'm liking it even more.
Like, okay, so remember to be present in what you're doing now, and not just being looking forward. Like, man, yeah, I wish I was doing this other thing. You're like, no, you're where you are. You're supposed to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can do all kinds of things with that, but here you are.
Right.
So be here.
Yeah. So be here.
Yeah.
Be present.
Yeah. Well, and we're in a culture right now where people are encouraged not to be. Right. Like it's just comparison. Over comparison. And that's been something that I've really been working on recently is, I always joke about this, but like the day that I realized the second that I hope or wish or want to play for somebody, like play for an artist or like see something on Instagram, oh man, that looks like a cool, you know, the second I think that, it means that I'm hoping that the person who has that job loses their job.
Yes.
And boy, is that rude.
Yeah.
Like,
that's so
goodness.
Good.
Yeah.
Let's go. I love that.
John is straight.
Honestly,
truth
that's like,
right now.
And that's called being a hater.
Yeah.
Right,
and that's
literally.
Not you. And that's not many of us, but we do feel, you know, we feel that.
It seeps in though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And jealousy.
Yeah.
And just like, well, how does he have that gig?
Yeah. And you know what you do with that? Because it is, and here's the reality. It's okay to have a little bit of that. But when you do, if that's your homie, you got to tell him. And that's what I did. That's my
bro. I was coveting.
Bro, I straight up like my buddy Joel got this gig that I was like, that's so dope. I was like, I would literally be a hater if I didn't tell you straight up. I am jealous and I wish that was me. I was like, I've been wanting to play with so and so forever.
Yeah,
I'm like, awesome, good for dude, you. Killer.
I saw a quote.
You deserve it.
That's good.
I forget who was by. There's a quote I saw a few weeks ago, and it was like, hone in on what you're jealous about, because that actually informs of what you secretly want. You know what I mean? Yeah. So like, if you're jealous that someone's on this gig, don't just be jealous, but use that as fuel and be like, okay, how can I get there? Because you're jealous for a reason.
Awesome.
Right? Like you want that, or you want a piece of whatever that is.
Yes.
Yeah, whether it's a lifestyle or it's a specific gig or whatever.
Wow.
That's really good.
Yeah. That's so good.
Yeah, that's good too, right?
I love this job, bro. It's the best job. We're getting all kinds of wisdom up in here.
Oh, yeah. All right.
No, that's so true. But yeah, no, but so to kind of circle back to the initial question.
I don't remember what the question was. Oh, but that's okay.
Just my how I got to Nashville.
Does. Oh yeah, LA and Nashville. Yeah,
but
sure.
Like, yep. But so I, man, like a lot of played a lot of wedding bands, a lot of corporate bands, which is great because the money's really good.
Yeah.
But what I found was it gets you going in circles.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can lose kind of the main reason why you're doing X, Y, and Z.
Right.
Yeah. So I remember. And again, it's extremely expensive to live there. And that fuels anxiety in everyone out there. And it fuels individualism. And so I found that I attached a lot of worth to what I was doing. And didn't realize at the moment, but like realize now how unhealthy that is. Because that'll destroy you, right? Like if you put your worth in what you do, then you're gonna mess up.
Yeah.
And then what's gonna happen? And for me, a lot of times I would just be wrecked after gigs.
Yeah.
If something bad happened, if I didn't, you know, one of my favorite jokes, that wasn't a joke, but the mentor that told me to read Inner Game of Tennis mentored me on Ableton and taught me Ableton and like running tracks live. And so we were setting up my live rig and he goes, you always want a kill switch for when you get off of the tracks.
Mm.
And arrogantly, I go, oh, I mean, if I get off the tracks, that won't happen. But if I get off the tracks, I need a kill switch. And he just like calmly goes, when you get off the tracks, meaning
listen,
like,
John,
it's going to happen. Yeah. Like, you know, but
things occur.
Things occur,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
and
it's technology.
And outside forces, right? And so when things like that would happen, when I would have a bad gig, it would send me into a spiral. Because it's like, if you put all your worth in what you do, then when you don't do it well, then you don't think you're a person worthy of anything.
Yeah.
You don't have any self-worth, right?
I think the balance, then this is my
boundless
with that, is I think it's okay to have a lot of your worth in doing things well, including failing. Fail
1,000%.
Well.
Yeah. That's good.
Like,
fail
you know,
forward, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, I made a mistake. I totally own it.
Yeah.
And doing like,
yes.
That, I think that's the healthy balance.
Don't ever not care about what you're doing.
Right.
Right. But don't make it such an identity that if you don't do it, then
I messed up this once, so I'm a bad person.
Exactly. Which 100%. Is what I would be. But so it was interesting. I simultaneously met my wife on a tour that I was on. My now wife. She wasn't my wife when I met her, but I wanted it,
this
though.
This is crazy.
Weird,
we're married.
Right?
Oh, my God.
Nice to meet you.
Well, your name is
Arranged this. Marriage is the shit, dog.
But I met her on a tour that I was on. I was in Atlanta, and she came to see the artist I was playing for. And we ended up dating long distance for 10 months. Which was great because we had to like talk on the phone every day and it took away the distraction of being there physically, right? So we had to get to know each other. But so we did that for 10 months straight. She would come to LA 1 month, I'd go to Nashville 1 month, and we just kind of do that. And then one of us was going to move, and it's way cheaper here, way cleaner, way nicer. and you know, the touring thing was an allure for me. So I put the feelers out and I got a job offer to play country, and it was like a 52 a week, a year job, like salaried.
Oh, wow.
But I mean, you know, just going out weekend runs, like it was, you know, playing at like Joe's Bar and Grill or like the Tin Roof Circuit or whatever.
Right.
It allowed me to move to Nashville, without doing another cold start, which took years off my life when I did it.
Yeah, man.
Oh, man.
Was that a gig that you auditioned for or like?
I never auditioned.
Gotcha.
I literally met the guy when I was in Nashville. We met up at Embers, which is the ski lodge bar in 12 South.
Right. Yep.
Amazing place. And it was December 14th. And he goes, cool. Can you be here by February 1st? Like, can you be here in 2 months, essentially?
Yeah, right.
So I move back to LA. Or go back to LA. I'm like, cool. Well, I'm moving, I guess.
I got a gig, yeah.
Interestingly enough, and this is a story for another day because this is Nashville Drummers podcast. but in the process of moving to Nashville, I got saved and like became a believer, which was like a really cool, really cool thing and like completely changed my life. But I moved to Nashville and I've been here ever since. It was funny because I only had that touring job for 2.5 months.
Wow.
And then I was like, oh, wait, I am in Nashville without a job.
Crap, I'm just like everybody else
now. You know, and it's been really interesting because people told me 5 years prior to me moving to Nashville, you should check out Nashville.
Yes.
And I ended up in Nashville anyway.
Right.
And so it's like, cool, I'm supposed to be here.
Mm. And I feel like that sort of happens to people. Like we end up where we're supposed to be, just like in life. You know, I think, I believe things happen for a reason.
1,000%.
So it's funny because I remember you were telling the story of like, it was Nashville or LA, or no, it was Boston or LA, right? But then you came to Nashville.
Yeah.
And it's just like full circle. Now you're back.
And I'm saying.
Now you're here.
You know, which is like really cool. And
yeah, man.
And yeah, it's been a very, very cool experience. And like, I think you know you're doing things right when you are doing something you never thought you'd ever do, right?
Like, yes.
You know, like, and in that, and then I'll stop spewing crazy stuff, but like, in that.
I haven't heard a crazy thing yet.
Yeah.
In that, don't be so, like, knowing that we're here, knowing that you've gotten to where you are today, and like, I like you as a person, I like you as a person, you know, everything that we've been through has made us who we are today and the people we've come in contact with and jobs we've had. So, A, why would you want it any other way? And even the good and the bad, the hurt and the, you know. And then also, if you look at what has happened to you, what makes you think you know exactly what you need to do in the future? So, like, why? Like, I've done this. Every time I've done this, it's backfired on me. But, like, when we find a job or a band or something that we want so desperately that we hold on to it, and like do anything we can do in our power to get it and like strive and like act the way we normally wouldn't act and do all these crazy things to get this one job because you think that, oh, that will do it. That is my meal
ticket. That completes me. Yeah.
But then if you hold that loosely, quote unquote, and you just go with it, then something even cooler comes out of the woodwork that you never could have ever imagined.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's kind of, there have been a couple of bands in town that I've been like, oh, like that's my dream gig. And every time that I've treated it as such, I've lost it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And like a better drummer has come along or dates don't work out and, you know, a big gig falls on my anniversary and you can't miss those. Can't miss the anniversary.
No,
you know what I mean? But like, or something that's important. And so you lose that gig and then something even cooler comes along. So it's like, it's a good reminder to me of like, hold things loosely and like, don't sweat the big things. Like don't sweat the small things. Like,
that's such great advice.
Just don't sweat.
Yeah.
Don't sweat. I mean, unless you're drumming, right?
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about what you're currently doing. The transition from you got that first gig in Nashville, then and like I look up to you still, you know, as a mentor or someone kind of like a first call drummer.
Thank you, yeah.
And you've obviously found a niche in Ableton, right?
Yeah.
So kind of walk us through how you've been marketing yourself that way and how you're, you know, staying busy as a full-time drummer.
Man, so I love something, again, kind of came with becoming a Christian believer. Love worship stuff, and they use Ableton a lot in those you know camps. I have found that I had the unique opportunity of moving to Nashville at a time when Ableton was starting to get popular. It was a little far behind LA in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Where I mean, LA was like, cool, all we need is a drummer who runs tracks and a singer. You know, like, put the bass in the tracks, but you know, whatever.
Was that 2019 then?
2019, moved here, February of 2019. And so I had the unique opportunity of coming here and kind of being someone who definitely knew my way around that program. And like when I played on Broadway, a lot of people would be like, oh, we were on tracks. And they like give me an iPod and they'll be like, yeah, it's like click on the left, like tracks on the right. And you're like, no, man, that's not what tracks are.
Hey, run tracks.
Not to be rude, but like, that's a karaoke song.
Yeah. Right. You run in track.
Run in track.
Singular.
Right? Yeah. You're doing sprints.
It's not even. Yeah. It's not even sprint.
Yeah.
But.
Sorry.
But yeah, so that's been a really cool opportunity to like get to use that in what I do. I say that I'm a drummer first, but like I do love integrating tracks into playing, especially because like I enjoy doing the whole hybrid drum setup. Mm-hmm. So I'll run like SPD pad with triggers and like you take samples from the tracks and you put them on your drums and you like, I know guys who do it way better than I do, but it's still kind of a fun like artistic thing.
Yeah. So did you teach yourself all that? Or was it kind of out of necessity?
It was, I had that one guy, that one mentor of mine in LA who taught me Ableton. Mm-hmm. But then from there it was like teaching myself out of necessity.
Yeah. That's kind of what I've been doing here.
Yeah.
I don't quite have a gig for it. So I'm in this weird, like do I invest? Because it's expensive to get all if it's the drummer that has the setup or it's the artist, it depends, right?
Right.
It's like, do I invest now in all of that and then I'll get the gig? Or do I kind of, you know, oh, I have a gig in next month. Let me now invest.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm trying to figure that out myself.
That's a great question. I feel like,
I mean, in the meantime, I'm learning Ableton. So you don't need to.
And that's a great,
you buy the program once. And
I would say for anyone who is wanting to learn it, get Ableton. Don't get Ableton Lite, right? Get the
real thing.
Get the real thing. Don't need Suite. Like, I don't have Suite. I think that's great for producers, but like, I haven't found a lot of need for it in running tracks. And then, I mean, I'm a big believer in like, if you get a gig that you need it, see if you can borrow it. Mm-hmm. And if it's a thing that's going to keep happening and you can justify buying it for that, then go for it.
Mm-hmm.
But like, there are some great interfaces out there, like the iConnectivity. I forget what it's called. It's like 12 play or something.
That's like the dual.
Yeah, you can run a redundant rig.
Redundant, yeah.
Which
I've heard about
for
that.
Way cheaper. It's $600 for this one thing instead of to do a redundant rig. It used to be like $1,500, $1,600.
Yeah.
So that's been great. But I'm it's funny kind of talking about like, don't, you know, get excited for something tomorrow if you don't know, you know,
right?
Like don't brag about what you're doing next if something completely different could come out of the woodwork. But I actually just started playing for this country band. And I swore off country when I moved here after the first band. I was like, I'm a pop guy and I'm a worship guy. And I will never do, right? Like, but I'm like, it's funny how anytime that we have an opinion about something, we get proven wrong about that opinion.
So
I'm playing. I just got a job, like an official offer to play for this country band. They're kind of like the Chicks, which I don't know if I'm allowed to say the original name of the band.
Say it.
It's the Dixie Chicks. Yeah. They're not called the Chicks. They're Dixie Chicks. But,
Since when are we offended by that kind of?
Like, not on this podcast. Lord.
But anyway, but they're like that. It's like amazing harmonies. Three girls up front, and then bass player and guitar player. They're called the Sweet Tea Trio, and they're just like awesome girls. Great music. Just kind of like fun, like 90s country kind of stuff. Great harmonies. But, and I'm like not running tracks for that, even though like I might be, like who knows what the future holds. Mm-hmm. But like, it's just funny how you find yourself in those situations where you're like, oh, I thought I was going to be doing this. And you're like, oh, actually, I got this pretty cool gig with this awesome band and I'm playing country and I'm not running tracks.
That's almost like the market decided for you.
Exactly.
It's like you have skills that, or, you know, makes you hireable, and then that need will find you.
Kind of thing. Well, and like, I'm a big believer, and I'd love to hear what y'all think. Something that got beaten out of me pretty quickly in Nashville was in LA, I took anything and everything.
Mm.
And it was a form of affirmation, but it was also like to make money, right?
Right.
But like, would take as many gigs as I could, and I would, whatever. When I moved here, I saw how many insanely amazing players live here. And any time that I found myself taking a gig for the money and I didn't like the music, first of all, it was horrible to have to learn the music because you're like, you listen through it, like the song twice, and you're like, I can't do this anymore,
mm-hmm.
right? So you don't give it the due respect it deserves, no matter what kind of music. But I would find, like, especially like playing on Broadway a lot, like playing songs that I didn't enjoy, I realized that there were 20 other drummers waiting in line behind me who would have killed to do that. And I was like, cool, so what am I doing? I'm stealing other people's work. Mm-hmm. And I'm not liking it. And I'm not giving it the justice it deserves. So what am I doing?
Yeah.
And that's sort of the way I feel when I see anybody playing. And again, we all have bad days. But anytime I see anybody playing on a stage, no matter where they are, and if they don't look like they're having fun, I'm like, cool, go get a different job.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's an honor and a pleasure every time you sit behind a drum set. And it's cool. If you don't like the music you're playing, that's okay. But like, there's someone out there who would like to do that.
Yeah.
So don't steal other people's work. I love
that mindset. That's such a nice, you know, community way to think about it. And not selfish. So. Just like, if you're not enjoying it, like someone else, it's meant for you. Like you take this gig.
Right. Well, yeah. And again, you know, that's a blanket statement. And everyone has their own circumstances and reasons why they do things. I believe, and you can learn a lot from playing music that you don't love, honestly.
Yeah.
But that being said, I think always checking your motive and making sure that you're not just being a gig hog, because I was a gig hog for 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, like where I'd play anything and everything. And I think that's an unhealthy way to approach things. And it doesn't help anybody. Mm. It doesn't help the artist you're playing for. It doesn't help you. And like, you might get pigeonholed into that
right.
genre, and then you always hate the music you play. Right?
Like, yeah.
I was kind of like having a conversation with myself, as one does.
I love that. Yep.
Yeah. And I was thinking about the whole thing with, like, it happens a lot in the city. I'm sure it happens in LA too. Yeah. That's kind of what you're describing. But I'm going to play with so-and-so because they've got like this many followers on Instagram, right? And I think it'll be good for me. And I'm like, yeah, but do you want to do that thing?
Yeah.
Because you're building a reputation.
Yes.
Right. As you do these things. And if you start building a reputation, a positive one,
right,
but a reputation within a genre that you actually ultimately don't have an interest in pursuing, then you're being counterproductive.
1,000%.
Yeah. Like, 'cause it's not easy to just move over from that thing.
No one's like, oh man, that guy's a killer country player. I bet he's an awesome jazz player.
Right.
I bet his double bass chops for prog are great. Like, what? No.
I mean, right. It's kind of similar to a brand. Like, the brand is not necessarily what DW or Pearl puts out on Instagram. It's what people think of you as your brand, you know? And like, if they know you as a country drummer, you know, on Broadway, that's eventually what you're going to be known for. And you're not going to get any other gigs.
1,000%.
Yeah, this comes up literally every episode.
Really?
Yeah. I would implore people to listen to episode 17 with Marcus Finney, because he had one of the best perspectives specifically about, you know, taking gigs early on and saying yes to everything and then, you know, knowing your value.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah. And know, like, your value. Yeah.
Not being afraid to, you know, say your rate and
Yeah, well, he said the now becoming infamous line, which I love, is just like, yes is expensive.
Yes.
Oh, I love that.
Well,
so good.
I had a buddy of mine in LA tell me one time, he goes, the best part about, and this is like a whole other mindset, but it was going along with what you were saying. The best part about being a freelance musician is you can always say no. Mm-hmm. You get a chance to like pick your jobs every day. But the second you say yes, you have to do it to the absolute best of your ability.
Yes.
And if you feel like you're underpaid, if you feel like you're learning too much music or whatever, X, Y, and Z, you do that to yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of that, like, do it to the best of your ability.
Yeah.
Because you did say yes, right?
Like, you did.
Yeah.
You could have said no.
But. Yeah. Yeah, I was similar to you. I don't think I was a gig hog necessarily, but I was definitely like saying yes a lot more than I probably should have early on.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I'm kind of dialing it back.
Oh, good.
And like, maybe I play 2-3 times a month, but like, those are gigs I'm excited for.
Right. Yeah.
They're like you said, like, yes, like 100%, like Derek Sivers, right?
Yeah.
Like, you're all in for that one.
That's a pleasure to play that music on stage, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think people just, you know, you learn that over time.
You do.
So it's good balance. Well, should we?
Can't believe how fast.
Let's wrap it up. Yeah.
2 hours goes by.
Since you came in here, I've been meaning to ask you about the tattoos.
Yeah.
Same. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So
want me to go through?
Let's go through the left arm.
If you can, maybe put them on the go left like that, arm, and then you'll probably get on the
first,
video.
First is, this is my most recent one, actually. I got it in Lebanon, Tennessee.
Lebanon.
It is a.
For anyone who doesn't live here,
it's not Lebanon.
It's Lebanon.
Lebanon. So it's my favorite Bible verse. It comes from Matthew 5:14 3:16. It's you are the light of the world, like a city on a hill. No one takes a lamp and puts it under a basket. They put it on a lampstand so that the entire house can see the light. And it's just a reminder for me to be joyful and to find the great things in life and, and be a light and be kind. So that's my newest one. This one is, it's my wedding date, which is 6/25/2019. And then the date I got saved, which was 12/25/2018.
Dude,
which is cool. Christmas Day. Look at that. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, buddy. Two rebirths right there.
Two rebirths, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. And then I got Orion, the constellation.
Mm-hmm,
I grew up in Maine.
Oh, those are drumsticks.
Oh, no. This is just...
cool.
But that would have been cool. I should have done that. I grew up in Maine, lived in Los Angeles, live here now. Every time I look up at the sky and I can see stars, 9 times out of 10, the first constellation I see is Orion's Belt.
Mm.
And so it's just an awesome reminder of like, I'm home. Wherever I am, I'm home.
Dude, love it.
Right? And so then my wife always said that my spirit animal is a golden retriever.
Aww.
Because I'm bubbly and smiling and you can smack me and I'll still come back.
So, and you shed everywhere.
Right? I shed everywhere. And then over here.
Now we're talking. Okay.
This is Africa by Toto.
Oh,
yes.
Dude.
It's the dun, 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 and it goes around. And then Boston Skyline.
Oh, that is
LA
so cool.
Skyline. And the guy who did this, he came up with the idea of making it into the staves.
That's which really, really cool.
So I was like,
that's so cool.
Shout out. He lives in LA still.
Dude, look behind you. That's next, right?
That's absolutely. I'm trying to figure out where I'm going to put that because I'm done with this arm. Yeah. I eventually want to do a full
National Skyline face tat.
Go!
Who's going to be the first to get it?
No, I meant National Drummers Podcast tattoo.
Tattoo, oh, really?
Yeah, that's actually jokes on you. That's a requirement for all of our guests. You actually signed a contract. You don't know it yet.
No.
Real quick, anyone who goes and gets a Nashville Sky... No. Well, actually, you can get National Drummers Podcast or the Nashville Skyline. If you tattoo it on your face, I will give you $100.
We'll give you a free drum head.
Yeah, yes. A free drum head.
Yes.
We're not kidding.
Yeah.
If you get that tattoo... We will give you a free drum head.
I'm thinking about it.
Oh, that's great. Dude, that's awesome.
And a crisp high five.
Okay, I have one more question.
Anything.
Just favorite spots around town, favorite places to go eat.
Yes. I love, really love Will Hagen's, which is like a dart bar by the airport, which is really good.
Interesting.
It's like a dive bar.
Like Donaldson?
Really, yeah.
Okay.
That was sick.
Love ML Rose.
Yeah.
They have amazing happy hours. They got a couple spots around town.
Yeah.
Stay Golden is my favorite.
It's a great vibe
shop.
There.
Great food, great coffee.
Yeah.
I think that's it for my. Those are my go-tos.
Yeah, man.
Around. I live in like Little Mexico. I live in Nippers Corner, like right on.
Oh, awesome.
Nolensville Pike.
Yeah, I used to live right over there.
Oh my gosh, there's a couple of great taco places.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So. Well, that being from California and moving here, realizing for the first maybe year.
Yeah.
Much to my horror and to my wife's horror, that a lot of Mexican food places here don't. They just don't.
They don't.
Like, just, oh, how's the, oh, where can you get good Mexican food? Nope.
Don't even think about it.
Yeah, just try to forget that that's a food group that you were into. Then discovering all of Nolensville Pike and being like, thank you, Jesus.
We found it.
My gosh.
Yeah.
Like, there it is. Fine. Yeah. And now there is a fire taco truck right down the street from my house. Thank God.
We're so
happy. What's it called?
I can't remember.
Don't worry.
For the life of me.
Text
but
me.
It's out. It's over in Hermitage. It's like almost right across the street from Dutch Bros.
Okay.
If you know where that is.
Yeah, I know that is. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I got it. Give me that pastor.
Ooh.
Yep. Dude, John, it was so great to sit down with you.
Thank you all for having me. I really, really love today.
Yeah, man.
Really
where can people get a hold of you?
Ooh, Instagram.
Okay.
Young John Butterworth is my handle. It was a nickname I had in LA, but I should probably change it. Facebook, John Butterworth. J-O-N, not J-O-H-N.
Yeah.
And, I'll give my number out if people want it.
Cool.
Love it.
Awesome, man.
Boys, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Nashville Drummers Podcast.
If you liked it, please consider leaving us a review on the Apple Podcast app.
Also, check out our new website, NashvilleDrummersPodcast.com. And if you're not already following us on Instagram, you can follow us at Nashville Drummers Podcast.
This episode was recorded at Diamond Sound Studios, located in Nashville, Tennessee.
Sponsored by Music Lab Nashville, production by The Wise Company. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.